Main Squeeze Blues. Nobody's key fits my lock the way yours does, baby. Nobody has that long, slow slide. Nobody writes me letters that burn up the mail slot. Nobody stays up the whole night waiting for a ride. I had a party with fancy ducks and chickens reading from Shakespeare and telling lies. They ate up the buffet and spilled wine on the carpet. Nobody's key fits my lock the way yours does, baby. Nobody cooks me Santa Fe stew. Nobody rocks me when I feel like crying. Nobody tunes their strings to my perfect pitch. I had a fling with the chief of police, cruising black and white, clinching to the crime radio. But he never stayed till morning.
Left me. You're listening to author, poet, dancer and friend to KRCB, Jenny Orvino, from her 2002 Grammy-nominated spoken word album, Make Love, Not War, which explores the body erotic and the body politic while collaborating with some of San Francisco's finest musicians. I'm Suzanne Lang, and tonight it's poetry, politics, and passion with Jenny Orvino on her new book. We'll also feature her 2005 interview with Robert Bly from the archives of KRCB's Word by Word. And Barbara Quick is here with her review of Swamplandia. It's a novel idea. I hope you'll stay with us.
But I couldn't fry what I hatched. Nobody's key fits my lock the way yours does, baby. Nobody grows me roses and snips off the thorns. Nobody gives me all their money like a gambler who's done. Nobody rubs me down like a deer at a salt lick. I had a baby, dark-haired and smart as mink. By evening, I was blood-tired and full of weather. Her daddy left me for a black Cadillac. No, no, nobody's key fits my lock the way yours does. Baby, nobody's key sounds so welcome late at night. Nobody kisses like the end of the world, baby. Nobody unlocks me the way you do.
Jenny Orvino has been part of Sonoma County's art scene for years with her essays, poetry, and performance pieces. And yes, she originated Word by Word, a literary staple of local public radio, currently hosted by Gil Manserk. And now Jenny Orvino has published a volume of memoir, poetry, and essays. And I was pleased to sit down and talk with her about her life and work.
When you were 22 years old, you said, "I believe my purpose in life is to write poetry and to work for peace." And threaded through your book, it seems that you've held true to that in a fluid way, and that it's been your life's journey. Why don't you talk about that purpose in life, that 22-year-old Jenny talking about her purpose in life?
It's amazing that the 22-year-old is not that much different from the 65-year-old in some ways, which surprised me. Hopefully I'm more mature. But when I had a
personal coach a couple of years ago, and he was asking me what I thought my mission was. I was trying to see if there was something that I could say that was different from that. And I really couldn't come up with anything. It seems that that held true. I pay a lot of attention to what's going on in the world. I listen to alternative media and I read. I don't feel that I'm so much of an out-in-the-street activist as I used to be. I feel that my activism comes from and within the writing more than anything else now.
Though when you were 20, 22, a young woman, you dove in a way that was unabashed, it seemed, into that was a very vibrant time in the late 60s.
Well, 1968 was such a pivotal year, the summer of love and all. And I was graduating from college at that time. So it was an exciting time. I went to an all-girls Catholic college. Now, people would think, oh, that is so conservative, and how could you come out of there being a political activist? But that was my incubation. That was my grounding, because I was hanging out with the radical left of the church, the Father Daniel and Phil Berrigans, the people who felt that their conscience was what was leading them to what they did in the world, their moral conscience, the gospel, Gandhi. So in a way, maybe if I had gone to a more secular university, I wouldn't have had the same convictions that I had as a result of going to Catholic school as I did.
I related so much with your book when I picked it up and read it. I felt like it. I had some similar experiences. I went to a small Mennonite college, and it also was the same sort of incubation of introducing me to concepts that helped provide a language for maybe unformed things in me.
And the opportunity for leadership, too, when there were no boys in class to compete with or to look coy for. The women who were my role models were my classmates, my hall proctor who introduced me to radical ideas, when I was a freshman and she was a senior, the terrific priests who were our chaplains.
I wonder where some of that leadership is now in the church.
Well, it seems to me they've gone backwards since John 23.
It does seem that way.
I mean, we've gone backwards in a lot of ways. I feel like today we're fighting for things that we accomplished years ago.
Why do you think that is?
I think corporate money and the corporate takeover of our democracy is why. Because you can see it in everything from climate change to militarism. It's all the same. It's the war profiteers. It's the people who are making money from armaments, from, you know, colonialism,
yes.
Imperialism.
Yes, yes. And let's get to your book.
Okay.
You talk a lot about this in your book, and it's a memoir. It's a collection of your poetries and essays.
I think I made the book because I was seeing a lot of parallels from the 60s to now, and also because I wanted to get back in touch with that time of my life where I felt so right and so alive and so sure of everything. And it started because somebody asked me for my political biography for a poetry reading that I was doing, and it made me start thinking about it and writing down my credentials. And then I took a prose writing class from Dan Koshner, and I started writing prose. I started writing memoir and little essays. And that's really how the book came about. The memoir is the last thing I've written. The poems are collected, poems, basically, and the essays came along as I was writing for my spoken word CD. Some of the pieces are from that. And so I don't know, because of my age, I guess, I thought if I'm going to do a book, I better do it now.
And you dedicate the book to your parents. And the book opens with your exchange with your parents about a departure that you were taking that seemed natural to you, that wasn't what they had in mind, perhaps, but yet it seems like your parents went with you on a lot of this, maybe whether they liked it or not.
Well, they loved me, and so they tolerated a lot of things. And as I say in one part of the memoir, I think that they were much more tolerant of me than I was of them. And perhaps not that they loved me more than I loved them, but I think they were more unconditional in their love. And I didn't realize it until later. I think all children of the 60s had a generational conflict. We were reacting to the 50s. Feminism was a reaction to those times. We were responding to the draft and the war. And in a way, we couldn't help it. It was thrust upon us in a very big way. I think what's happening these days is that so many people are not affected by what is going on elsewhere in the world. We have only a small segment of the poor and others who have been returning to these wars for multiple deployments and who are getting shot up and their lives destroyed and their families destroyed. But the majority of people are not directly affected. We don't have a draft. Every single young man doesn't have to make a decision about what is he going to do. Is he going to register? Is he going to go to jail? Is he going to go to Canada? Those were critical decisions for every man of 18 years old when I was 18 years old. And that is not happening now. And I think that is a big difference. There we have a, you know, not only is there the 1% and the percent of the 1% that has the control of the wealth, but there's also the privilege of not having to do the dirty work.
And those times are threaded through your narrative, through your memoir. It was such a time of aliveness and charting your own course in a way. And you met some pretty interesting people. You were really at the nexus of a lot of activity. And I felt like as I was reading your book and all these names popping up in very intimate ways, why don't you talk about some
of
these relationships?
Well, I hope that it doesn't sound like name dropping. But in a certain way, the people that I met were my teachers and role models along the way. My first boyfriend was a draft resister. He went to jail for refusing induction. And so I wrote a little essay called Girls Say Yes to Boys Who Say No, which was a quote from Joan Baez, who at the time her husband, David Harris, went to jail for refusing to go to war. And so I don't know. It's not that I followed her advice, but in a sense I was attracted to activist men of conscience. And my first boyfriend, Bob, I was able to follow him in a certain way. Granada Television made a documentary about him, and I would show that film to various groups and talk about it. The wonderful poet Denise Levertov took that film and showed it on the East Coast because she was a member of Resist at the time, and they were a group of adults who supported young draft resistors. Her husband was in the Dr. Spock trial. He was one of the defendants in that trial for supporting young draft resistors. So I did meet celebrities in a sense, but they were celebrities like the poets who were traveling the country doing readings, poetry readings against the war. And so that's how I met Robert Bly. So I have a section in my memoir about Bly, and I was able, years later, 30 years later, to interview Robert Bly for this radio station. So some of those relationships stayed over the course of years.
There was, in your book, a real sweetness about that relationship, it seemed.
And the same thing happened with the radical lawyer, William Kunstler, who defended the Milwaukee 14, who were 14 priests. I mean, it had a a nonviolent, religiously moral basis. That act of, we are going to pour napalm on draft files, we're going to pour blood on draft files as an act of conscience to illustrate, and we're willing to go to jail in order to put this in the public eye. We were very conscious of media at the time to try to get the anti-war message out into the public. And so I met William Kunstler because he was defending them. Then he subsequently defended the Chicago Seven, which was a very famous big media trial. And I had the fortunate opportunity, I guess, to become intimate with him for a little while, which for a 23-year-old, it was a pretty spectacular experience. And then my daughter's father, my first husband, not the same person as the draft resister, but he also refused induction and had to face that. And he decided to face it in a different way, which was not to go to jail, not to go to Canada, but to fail his physical and to abuse his body to such a point that he failed his physical and was able to get out of the Army that way. So there were many ways that people were trying to not serve, and it seems that I met a lot of them and was involved with them.
Well, you bring up your relationship with William Kunstler, and that too is something that is threaded throughout the story, your own sexual exploration and expression, and I'll say even advocacy of just even the frankness with which you talk about it, not only in your memoir, but in many of the other activities you've been involved with. And some people might be shocked by that even now, yet it seems like something that emerged out of those times.
I did a reading recently where one of the audience members said, you know, when I was listening to you, I didn't feel uncomfortable or voyeuristic. I just felt like you were sharing your insight and experience with me, and that included me rather than put me off. And so I felt very enlightened by all your writings about sexuality. And that is a topic. Sexuality and relationships is a topic that I'm extremely interested in. And my spoken word CD, which is called Make Love Not War, I made that CD in 2002. And it was a hard marketing sell because the erotic bookstores and the sensuality shop and so on did not want to sell it because it was too political. And the political bookstores did not want to sell it because it was too erotic. But what the CD is a combination of anti-war poems and erotica. And the way I put them together is you can transform the world from the body. And that if we could just, I know somebody once said, maybe if those dictators had a more loving more loving relationships, they might not be so able to kill and torture people. So,
well, I think about the matriarchal bonobos that really use sexual pleasure as a means of communication and to defray tension, especially among the males in their community. Yet now I think we're looking at these animals a little differently, but sometimes I wonder if they've not been examined the same way as chimpanzees or gorillas because people are afraid of it. I don't know. But in your book, you do really, I'm going to say, naturalize. The conversation is very easy and natural. And I found that engaging in a way, well, that I appreciated. And I think our readers will, too, just in the same way this person talked to you at your reading.
Well, I've always been trying to tread that line between what is erotic and what is pornographic, what is enlightening and what is offensive, and just trying to find where that space is, especially because as a woman, I have not enjoyed very much, quote, pornography or what passes for erotic literature or erotic films. And so I thought, well, if I don't like what other people are doing, then I should just do it myself and try to write about topics like masturbation, all the no-nos, just to say, well, this is what it's about, and this is how I feel most alive. I mean, the goddess gave me sexuality to get me through how difficult this life is, you know. And often I thought, oh, during the Bush years, if only I had some great lover and I could just stay in bed all day and I wouldn't have to think about what was going on in politics. But nevertheless, it didn't happen that way, and I had to engage.
Well, I thank you for your conversation in the book that way. I thought it was great. And I think sometimes we avoid the conversation when it is something we all have in common, and yet somehow feel that it has to be pornographic or hidden some way. I mean, and I think even when you talk about yourself as a child, I think children, probably it's a very natural thing for children to be exploring themselves and giving themselves pleasure, yet it's not what we're supposed to be doing.
No, my grandmother caught me tickling my cookie, right? And you're not supposed to do that. And I didn't know why, but I knew it was something bad, but it didn't stop me from doing it.
Well, it's pretty hard. And you just used a phrase, tickling your cookie, and you have a poem in your book that I really loved. Do you want to read it now? That
Words They Gave Us.
Words They Gave Us, that I thought was kind of a good take on just what we're talking about.
Words They Gave Us. Scratched on lavatory walls, chalked on concrete bridges, whispered in my ear when I picked up a midnight telephone. Cunt, pussy, slit, beaver, muff, box, hair pie. Even a sweetheart struggles to find a phrase that doesn't blunt the sensual edge. Heart of the peony, jade gate, cinnabar cave, whisper this to me, anemone of Venus, ripe peach, lotus flower, little bell. Praise yoni, the vulva, adorned with a ring of gold. Spray paint fences and billboards with what my lover calls her cookie, rosebud, velvet valentine.
Thank you. I wanted to ask you a little bit about your process of writing. And you're a poet, and I think you mentioned someplace, maybe on your website or in your book, that you, from an early age, considered yourself a writer and have obviously been writing poetry your whole life.
I got a diary when I was 12 or 13 years old with a lock and key, and I used to write in my diary, and I still keep a journal. I have boxes and boxes of journals. So journal writing, that kind of writing, not necessarily for publication, has been really useful in my life. And I think journal writing can be good for everybody. It just helps you clear your head, understand yourself. By comparing old journals, you can see the progress you've made. When I was writing the memoir, I used the journal to do research and to find out, well, when did such and such a thing happen and what happened first, second, and third? So journal writing is one thing. My first poems were, of course, unrequited love poems, where you're writing about, you know, the guy in eighth grade when you're in sixth grade, and, you know, he's the football hero or the star or whatever, and you write about that. I think I'm actually rather neurotic about my writing when I'm writing for getting a finished piece. I mean, I would think I would write, you know, one or two poems a year, and I hear about people who are writing poems every day, and then I start feeling inferior and, oh, I'm not producing, and so on and so forth. But I mean, I've been trying to relax about writing and say there's no obligation. I'm not a vending machine where you put in the quarter and the poem comes out, or you put in, you know, a dollar and a chapter of a novel comes out or something. That is not the way it goes. I mean, I have to be pretty worked up usually to write about something. And if there's one thing that I want to encourage anybody to, is to really try to give yourself nourishment. Give your inner artist nourishment. Because I think humans were made to be creative. I mean, if we're made in the image of what created the universe, it's all about creating. And self-expression is what we're here for, I feel. So when I'm doing some kind of creative work, it doesn't necessarily have to be writing or painting. I mean, just being out in the garden this morning and watering and looking at the tomatoes and talking to the flowers, that just made me feel so much in my soul self, in who I am. And I think it is about creative, making something beautiful, making a beautiful home, making a beautiful garden, making a beautiful meal. I love to cook, and it's sort of the same process.
I want to read something from your book as well. You say, "When I see candid photos or my image reflected on the computer screen, I see an older woman, the mother of Rachel and grandmother of Theo, pale and with gray hair making a ghostly halo when I push it back. But I'm still alive, still that woman longing to create and live in a world more compassionate, more poetic, more just, and more free." I guess I related to much of what you said in that of inside you are still that 22-year-old, yet when you catch a glimpse of yourself, maybe it reminds you of the road you've traveled in a way.
That brings me to think about my birthday coming up. I will be 66 on July 29th. I have applied for Social Security, and I'm ready to receive it, my full benefit. But I am having a book launch party at the Occidental Center for the Arts on that day, on my birthday, Sunday, July 29th at 4 o'clock. And I will be reading from my book. I will have some wonderful musician friends of mine to perform with me. Bonnie Brooks, the wonderful vocalist, is going to sing a couple of songs, kind of punctuating the prose reading that I do. And then I have two musicians from the Santa Rosa Symphony, where I work, Karen Zimmerman and Jeanette Eisenberg, bass player and a violinist. And they're going to improvise with some of the poems that I'm playing. So I look forward to that reading just for the addition of the musicians. And I have worked with musicians all my life. I mean, coming down from, you know, the beatnik generation, I guess, my forefathers and mothers who played in the coffee house or performed in the coffee houses with the bongo drums in the background. Ever since I started writing poetry, I enjoyed working with musicians. And so my CD, of course, is not just spoken word, but there's music. And many of my collaborators on there were good friends of mine who came into the studio and gave me their talent for payment of a bottle of wine or something. So I really enjoy working with musicians, and that's what we're going to be doing at Occidental Center for the Arts on July 29th. And it really is a benefit for the center. there's no charge, no admission charge, and I am giving a percentage of any books I sell to the center.
So that is a birthday party that all are invited to.
Correct.
And all of our listeners. And your book is Poetry, Politics, and Passion, Memoir, Poems, Personal Essays.
Let's take a short break. You're listening to A Novel Idea on KRCB, public radio in the North Bay. We're here with Jenny Orvino talking about poetry, politics, and passion, her book, which is a memoir with poems and personal essays. I asked Jenny to read a bit from the book to give us a little flavor of her storytelling. Later in the broadcast, we'll listen to an interview Orvino did with her longtime friend Robert Bly, first heard on KRCB's Word by Word, a literary show for which Jenny was the original producer. And Barbara Quick reviews Karen Russell's Swaplandia. It's all ahead. But right now, let's listen to Jenny Orvino reading from her memoir, Poetry, Politics, and Passion.
I'll just start with just the very first page and read the epigram, which is from a song by the Indigo Girls called Let It Be Me. And the words are, if the world is night, shine my life like a light. September 23, 1968. It was my second Sunday in Milwaukee, a warm morning, as I headed to St. John's with a group of clergy and lay people who had been meeting all week to compose a statement urging the Catholic Church to actively resist war and racism. My shoulder bag was heavy with leaflets to pass out to congregants on their way in. I handed off the bag, however, before we got in sight of the big downtown cathedral. I was one of those designated to dress conservatively, to attend the mass and demonstrate from inside. Just before the sermon, our undercover contingent rose from our pews and walked in silence past the communion rail into the sanctuary. At first, our action was met with murmurs, and then the voices became louder, echoing from all sides, "Sit down and be quiet." Our spokesperson faced the congregation. With 15 of us lined up beside him, he attempted to read our request for the Archbishop to speak out against the Vietnam War. The previously serene churchgoers wagged their fingers and interrupted repeatedly. Then they left their seats to stand in front of us, continuing to holler, "Love it or leave it! Communists!" We decided to read in unison so they couldn't drown out our words and quickly passed around copies of our statement. The paper trembled in my hands and my voice sounded hoarse. I remember a woman yelling inches away from my face, and I responded by kissing her on the cheek. I noticed her clip earring, felt her silky face powder, not unlike my grandmother's. It was scary. It was exhilarating. Our friend, Nick Rydell, assistant pastor at another church in the diocese, attempted to ascend the speaking pulpit. Even though he had donned his rarely worn Roman collar for this occasion, Father Rydell was barred from the microphone by uniformed police who emerged from the sacristy. Apparently, they had been called in advance. The officers and church authorities formed a solid phalanx at the rear and herded us back through the opening in the altar rail. The assembly voiced their approval. But as soon as all the demonstrators had been forced into their pews, something possessed me to stand up again. It was an adrenaline-fueled impulse. Angry that our protest had not gone as planned, I strode back to the altar steps and sat down, alone. A distressed "ooh" rose from the congregation. My comrades rushed to join me. There was a tumult of vestments, altar boys, parishioners, and police before my world went paisley red with pain. I was picked up from the floor by two index fingers pressed behind my ears. One burly cop used that neat trick of persuasion as he and his partner ushered me down the aisle and out a side door. I lost a shoe along the way. As in an old-time Western movie where a guy comes flying through the saloon's double doors and the bouncer wipes his hands clean of the character, I was dumped. By sheer luck, I was not arrested, as those who followed my example were. The next day, both the morning Milwaukee Sentinel and the afternoon Milwaukee Journal had the same photo on the front page. Miss Orvino, wearing a floral print sundress, hustled out of St. John's in the grip of two uniformed officers, her face contorted and her one stockinged foot pawing the air.
Jenny Orvino reading from her memoir, Poetry, Politics, and Passion. Jenny, I just have to make this observation. Several times in the book, there is a little bit of a recurring theme of you saying, "And I don't know what possessed me to," and then you launch off from there. So I trust that that's an impulse that remains to this day.
I'm afraid so.
Thanks for coming in today, and want to encourage our readers to visit you on your birthday.
Oh, thank you.
Sticks and stones, battle zones, single light bulb on a single thread for the black, sirens wail, history fails, rose-colored glass begins to age and crack, while the politicians shadow box the power ring, in an endless but decision never solve anything, from a neighbor's distant land. One for all, then we sing the common call.
let it be me.
This is not a fighting song.
On the vanguard of contemporary American literature, Robert Bly emerged as an outspoken activist, and in 1966 co-founded American Writers Against the Vietnam War. Though to many he is most noted for his book Iron John, a book about men, a critical examination of the fairy tale Iron John by the Brothers Grimm, which is part of Bly's deeper exploration into the circumstance of men in Western societies. There's so much more to say about Bly, but let's listen to this encore presentation of Jenny Orvino's 2005 conversation with Robert Bly upon the publication of The Winged Energy of Delight, Selected Translations.
So you've just published your second book of poems written in the intricate form called the Guzzle.
Mm-hmm.
Can you describe that poetic form?
Well, the ghazal is the oldest form in the Muslim world, and it began in the 10th century as a love poem among the Arabs. And then gradually it spread to all of the various languages in the Muslim world, including Farsi and Hindi. It has several characteristics that are very sweet. First of all, you're given 36 syllables, roughly, to say what you want to say. Another is that when the ghazal is fully developed, there isn't any rhyme, but the last word in every stanza is the same. So these were sung a lot. And so there's something very sweet about listening to some singer singing it very slowly, knowing that the word is going to come up again and again and again.
And why do they include the poet's name in the last?
Yes, a third quality is the poet mentions his own name at the end. And people are not sure about that, but I think it's possible that since the poems were sung all over the Islamic world, well, it could be sung in Cairo as well as in, you know, in parts of Egypt and other places to sort of identify the poem. But it also becomes useful in other ways. So I did one in which it said, in which the last sentence says, Robert, you know, some of the images in these lines are not bad. It's probably as good as anyone can do who is still living in the old inn of desire. So you can sort of rebuke yourself if you want to.
Well, I know, doesn't Ghalib say something about liking wine, you know, if he would be a better writer if Ghalib didn't like wine so much or something?
Well, he just says, you know, I know I'm not supposed to be drinking wine, but just pour some and you'll see words fall out of my mouth like blossoms.
In using this Islamic form, was there a particular reason for that? Are you trying to maybe bridge this so-called clash of?
Well, in a way, I mean, we're involved in humiliating the Muslims, and I'm involved in trying to praise them.
You've been translating throughout your whole career. Other translators have agreed with your statement that translating allows one to go deeply into the adventures taking place inside another person's mm-hmm. poem. But then you have also said translating with friends is one of the greatest pleasures in the world. So how have you experienced this particular pleasure?
Well, I know that it happened that I was interested in Georg Trakl. Turned out that when James Wright came back from a year in Europe, and especially in German-speaking country, he told me that he would come to the English department meetings at the University of Minnesota. And everyone would be talking about Janko Ransom, whom he loved, but, you know, that usual English sort of stuff. And then he would wait until he was drunk at midnight and start reciting Trakl in the original. I said, what happened? Everyone left the room. And so he was delighted to know that I was interested in that. So he and I did the first book, really, of Trakl into English. So we had many, 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 many gifts from that, and the friendship, doing that with the person that you love and admire who can do the next line better than you could. I mean, that's great. So I still love translation.
You've taken the title of the book from a poem by Rilke.
Yeah, and this is Rilke. This is Rilke. He's 1924, 2 years before he died. He's urging poets to do daring things. Just as the winged energy of delight carried you over many chasms early on, when you were in your 20s. The winged energy of delight carried you over many chasms early on. Now raise the daringly imagined arch holding up the astounding bridges. So he's saying that as a poet gets older, you can't just bubble forth your happy little tunes. You have to, go to two different sides of the river and build a bridge between. Miracle doesn't lie only in the amazing living through and defeat of danger. Miracles become miracles in the clear achievement that's earned. Well, that's very good, too, that somehow writing a poem in such a way that at the very last line the reader feels some kind of a miracle. To work with things is not hubris when building the association beyond words. Denser and denser the pattern becomes. Being carried along is not enough. And, someone like Jane Hirschfield really responds to this and does it. Take your well-disciplined strengths and stretch them between two opposing poles, because inside human beings is where God learns. And I read that, I read it the other day to like a 50-year-old woman, and she said, whoa, she couldn't believe what had just been said to her. Because inside human beings is where God learns. It's wild.
And the other great thing that you say about Rilke is that poets like to write about what the world is like after a hurricane or after a rainstorm, but Rilke likes to write about what the world is like after a great work of art has been created. The work of art changes the normal world.
Well, it comes along in this line, the love of excellence. The love of doing something inside poems, creating something marvelous, as opposed to turning on the ball game and to see this happens and that happened and that happened. And then you read a little novel and this happened and that happened. He's not interested in that. So we're losing more and more the intensity of poetry. Like you have in T.S. Eliot, it's very powerful, intense stuff.
I first met you in 1969 in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, when we had organized a poetry reading against the war in Vietnam. And so now I'd like to ask you to read your poem, Call and Answer, which has been published many anthologies, I think, now. It was in The Nation in 2002, even before.
Yeah, it's probably one of the first poems written about the Iraq War. And I used the guzzle form very roughly with it, keeping each stanza to roughly 36 syllables. I was very upset by the fact that no one was writing poems against the war. I still am upset by it. In the Vietnam War, they were coming out of our ears. Everyone was doing poems against the Vietnam War. Tell me why it is we don't lift our voices these days and cry over what is happening. Have you noticed the plans are made for Iraq and the ice cap is melting? I say to myself, go on, cry. What's the sense of being an adult and having no voice? Cry out. See who will answer. This is Call and Answer. We will have to call especially loud to reach our angels, who are hard of hearing. They are hiding in the jugs of silence filled during our wars. Have we agreed to so many wars that we can't escape from silence? If we don't lift our voices, we allow others, who are ourselves, to rob the house. How come we've listened to the great criers, Neruda, Anna Akhmatova, Thoreau, Frederick Douglass, and now we're silent as sparrows in the little bushes? Some masters say our life only lasts 7 days. Where are we in the week? Is it Thursday yet? Hurry, cry now, since Sunday night will come. So Sunday night, metaphorically, is the day he bombed Baghdad.
Why do you think people are not writing as many poems? Is it too soon in the war? Does the war have to go on?
I thought about doing that, too. It's quite possible that the Vietnam went on so long, we can't stand it anymore. But another thing is that the papers were not so panty-waisty at the time of the, you know. People wrote wild things and the papers printed them right away. And now the capitalists are trying to control everything and keep everything down. That's why it's important to think about Pablo Neruda. They were going to kill him. They sent hundreds to find him and kill him. We are being coddled by so many happy television programs. We don't realize, I don't think, what we're living in. Desperate situation.
Jenny Orvino with her friend Robert Bly. Finally today, Barbara Quick reviews Karen Russell's Swamplandia, a 2012 Pulitzer finalist, though ultimately no award in fiction was presented. Barbara Quick.
Looking for a novel I could really love, I chose the new paperback of Karen Russell's 2010 bestseller from Knopf, Swamplandia. Hailed by the New York Times Book Review as one of the 10 best books of that year, this debut novel crackles with quirkiness and imagination. If it had been written in the 19th century, I would have sworn the author was on opium when she wrote it. Swamplandia tells the tall tale of a family of alligator wrestlers in the Florida Everglades. During the summer, their lives fall apart. The big trees, husband, wife, and three teenage children, a boy and two girls, shake a living out of the swamp they call home by pretending to be Indians and hustling tourists to watch them risk their lives swimming among and wrestling with the gators. Miraculously, the gators don't bite. But the brave and lovely mom, star of the Big Tree Show, is killed off early on in the story by cancer. The business falls apart, the father can't cope, and the children are left to fend for themselves. The book's epigraph is from Through the Looking Glass, and the story is rather like a tropical version of Alice's surrealistic and highly symbolic adventures in a wonderland hatched inside the author's fertile and febrile imagination. There are nods to the magic flute in this novel, and I wonder if the author listened to Mozart's opera while she was writing Swamplandia. The story becomes darker, swampier, disturbed and disturbing as the plucky young narrator's Papageno changes into a rapacious bird of prey. Even though I was rapt with admiration as I read this novel, I felt a little horrified by the time I finished it. The story's eccentric birdman did what to the 13-year-old narrator? Are we simply supposed to gloss this over? The peculiarly North American brand of magic realism, conjured up so lavishly by Karen Russell, a handsome and gallant young ghost, an avian Pied Piper who volunteers to lead Ava Bigtree to the underworld in search of her haunted sister, all of this is dropped quite suddenly, slipping beneath the book's murky waters with nary a ripple and very little resolution. This worked just fine for Alice's adventures in Wonderland. Alice wakes up, has her tea, and all seems right with the world. In Swamplandia, the big trees, father and children, move into a motel room on the mainland, and the eldest daughter, who got married to a ghost, is put on antipsychotic medication. It makes for a distinctly unmagical and somewhat unsatisfying conclusion to the story. Make no mistake about it, Karen Russell is a fantastically talented young writer, and Swamplandia is a worthy choice for any book group, layered and complex and yet full of delights. Read it, and let me know what you think about the ending. I'm Barbara Quick for A Novel Idea.
Barbara Quick is a novelist and screenwriter, and if you want to let her know your thoughts on Swamplandia, visit her at www.askthewriter.blogspot.com. Before we say goodbye, I want to leave you with one last reading from Jenny Orvino's recent book.
A Face of Ecstasy. The invitation came via email, poking up from alerts and petitions I received during the 2003 Iraq-America crisis. The editors of a much-loved erotica journal, along with the founder of the Bay Area's most famous adult toy store, were looking for people willing to be filmed in facial close-up only during sexual arousal. After weeks of rage about the war and what was being perpetrated in my name, here was a daring diversion. And what did I have to lose? I had no boss to fire me, no spouse who might have objected. My parents passed away in 1995, and my remaining relatives live on the other side of the country. My adult daughter both adores me and tolerates my adventures, so that left only my ex. I seriously doubted he'd ever discover what I'd done. He's gone over to Jesus. Several years ago at the Wine Country Film Festival, I saw a short feature consisting entirely of faces of people at the moment of orgasm. It contained no vocals, just a musical soundtrack and the visuals of those contorted, blissful, and utterly vulnerable faces. Although I can't remember the name of the movie or find it in the film festival archives, it was a huge audience hit, an exposé of the highest order. Because that kind of radical art appeals to me, I decided to swallow my fear and sign on to reveal my own ecstatic face to the world. Saturday morning dawns clear and sunny. I listen to my favorite erotica tape as I drive to the city. At this stage of my life, I'm pretty free of shame, but not free of performance anxiety. How will I compare to the other female participants whom I imagine to be wildly multi-orgasmic? How wrinkled or shiny will my face look? Will I climax in a, quote, reasonable amount of time? Will I feel free to move and breathe the way I need to in front of strangers? When I come, I often squinch up my face and whip my head around. The director had asked me to keep my eyes open during orgasm. Would I be able to do it? I take it as a good sign that I easily find a parking space at Divisadero and McAllister. Inhaling deeply, I ring the bell, then climb the stairs.
You'll have to pick up the book, Poetry, Politics, and Passion, by Jenny Orvino to enjoy the rest of that story. Or you can catch her in person. She'll be having a birthday celebration at the Occidental Center for the Arts at 4 o'clock on Sunday, the 29th. What better reason to enjoy a trip to the West County than for some music and reading? And the sales of the book benefit the Occidental Center for the Arts. Jenny's spoken word CD, Make Love, Not War, is available online via CD Baby. Rosemary Manchester will return next month. Remember, you can subscribe to our podcasts. Visit us at www.krcb.org. I'm Suzanne Lang, and it's a novel idea. Thanks for listening.